Public health officials are trying to predict how the coronavirus could spread in the U.S. They're using data from China, but that may not be so accurate.
The contrast is, say, with Singapore, which has been fantastically transparent. All the data is available. That's the sort of model we all ought to adopt.
Also, the Trump administration has been combing through paperwork from past citizenship applications.
Digitization made it easier to go back and look at the older records and see if there were errors or problems in earlier immigration files.
If discrepancies are found, it could spell trouble for new Americans. And fears of the coronavirus are creating a run on some key supplies.
There's no toilet paper. Gotta look for a new way to wipe my bum now.
Yep, just telling it like it is. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you with us. To fly or not to fly, that is the question. A lot of us are saying, you know what, better play things safe. And so fears over the coronavirus are starting to eat into ticket sales. United became the first U.S. airline to cut domestic trips by about 10% come April. United's international flights have been slashed by 20%. Airline stocks are getting whacked. But it's not all coronavirus gloom and doom out there. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said today that there are encouraging signs. In several countries, including South Korea, the number of new reported cases appears to be slowing down.
The experience of these countries and of China continues to demonstrate that this is not a one-way street. This epidemic can be pushed back.
And Ghebreyesus pointed out that more than 100 countries still have no cases of the coronavirus. Nigeria has just one, a traveler who went to Italy. Nigerian officials say they are well prepared for coronavirus. After all, this is not Nigeria's first scare with a disease outbreak. But there is one thing they are worried about, fake news. The World's Halima Gikandi has our story.
The fake coronavirus news came well before Nigeria recorded its first case. It started with claims that millions of people were already dead from the disease, which isn't true, and then other claims that Africans are genetically immune to coronavirus, also false. And most recently, there was fake news on WhatsApp saying that there's a simple cure for it. The man in the message is claiming that drinking boiled garlic water can cure coronavirus, which, alas, is false. But this is the sort of information that David Ajikobi fights every day. He's the Nigeria editor at Africa Check, a nonprofit organization founded in 2012 to fight misinformation in African countries. Ajikobi says coronavirus is just the latest victim of fake news.
There's been a lot of misinformation and disinformation around it.
Fake news is a global problem. But in Nigeria, Ajikobi says misinformation on social media and messaging platforms can quickly end up on legitimate news outlets.
We see that it jumps from social media platforms into traditional media platforms.
Ajikobi's organization, Africa Check, has partnered with Facebook and other companies to fight misinformation online. They recently created a fact-checking service. It's a chat bot named Kweli, which means truth in Swahili.
So the idea is that people, you see something, you're not sure of the veracity, you send it to the chat bot.
Ajikobi's team then fact-checks the claims they receive on WhatsApp, which often means calling officials and scientists to verify the claims. This month, they plan to launch a new network of health journalists to debunk false information. Still, fighting fake news can feel like one step forward and two steps back. Take this week, for example. The word on the street was that the director of Nigeria's Center for Disease Control, Dr. Chikwe Ihekwazo, had been quarantined because he might have coronavirus. I called Ihekwazo up to see if that were true.
I'm perfectly well. I've had 3 tests just to be sure, and I've been working from home at full speed.
Ihekwazo was not quarantined. He was in self-isolation, just to be safe. He's leading by example, because Nigerian health officials recommend that people traveling from China, Italy, and other countries with high rates of community infection self-isolate for 14 days in case symptoms develop. Ihekwazo recently returned from a trip to China. He had gone with the World Health Organization to learn from China's experience.
So we've been preparing for this literally as soon as the outbreak broke, and that has really paid off for us in terms of we've ramped up our diagnostic capacity. We now have 5 molecular labs. where we can make the diagnosis.
Ihekwazo says countering misinformation is also part of the effort to fight coronavirus, because misinformation can be deadly.
Literally, lives depend on it. During the last Ebola outbreak, we had an incident where a fictitious cure was circulated. At that time, our communication did not respond as quickly as it should have. And we cannot even estimate the number of people that fell for it.
Ihekwazo says the Nigeria Center for Disease Control has set up a crisis communication team to provide accurate information to the public and to counter the misinformation. But he says it can take time away from the rest of their work. So in the meantime, they're relying on organizations like Africa Check to help them do the job. And their advice? Verify before you share. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Getting the right information is a problem everywhere. In some countries, it's made worse if the government does not have the public's trust. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel was a health policy advisor in the Obama White House and is now a vice provost at the University of Pennsylvania. When I speak with people around the world about COVID-19, I get a range of reactions from fear and panic to a blasé, oh, it's nothing kind of attitude. What is the correct response?
Depends whether you're a public health expert worrying about the overall public health, or you're an individual trying to figure out the individual situation. So if you think about it from an individual standpoint, the risks are low. We know that the numbers we're seeing everywhere in the world are probably significant underestimates, because there's a lot of either asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic people who we haven't tested. But nonetheless, from any individual standpoint, you know, it's kind of like having the flu around. You don't really change your life that much because of the flu. On the other hand, if you're a public health expert, there are lots of things to worry about.
What is the correct response if you're a public health official? What's the difference?
Well, public health officials are looking at the whole population. And, you know, if you look at flu in the United States, that's like 55,000 deaths. And we know that this coronavirus infection probably has a slightly higher death rate, although we can't be sure of. But if this virus spreads to millions of people, that adds up. And we may need more respirators. We may need more infrastructure than we have at the moment. So from a public health standpoint, this is a serious emergency. From an individual standpoint, it should change your behavior in a good way. You should wash your hands more, keep your hands out of your face more. But whether it should change your behavior, assuming you're relatively healthy, etc., that I think is a separate question.
Why is public trust in their public officials so important at a moment like this?
Well, they're going to have to guide you as to what the right behaviors are. Like, don't put those masks on. Don't buy those masks. And you have to trust them that they're giving you valid information. You know, if they're closing down a school, you have to trust them that that's okay. If they reopen the school and say it's safe, you have to trust them that that's okay to send your kids to school. So I think having the public follow what they're being told to do is, I think, very, very important, and not to panic. I mean, we have already seen some of the economic consequences, people boycotting Chinese restaurants as if, you know, this virus is, you know, hanging out in Chinese restaurants, which is totally false, yet can have devastating consequences for people without any factual basis. So I think understanding what's actually happening and being able to rely on your public officials is important.
Yeah, don't panic. That's a tough one to kind of have realized. How do you build public trust? Like, what experiences did you have in the Obama administration with this sort of thing?
First of all, you have to acknowledge it's going to get worse before it's going to get better. Because of more testing, we're going to see a big increase in the number of cases. We may see a big increase in the number of deaths, unfortunately. So you just have to acknowledge to people, here are the data, here's why it's happening. Second, you have to give people, we're on top of this. Here are the 5 things we're doing. You know, we are going to make sure there's no drug shortages. So we're working with the drug companies to get the raw materials. We are going to make sure there's no shortage of personal protective equipment. We're going to make sure that, you know, we have hospital surge capacity in the areas that we have. We're going to let you know what we're doing and give you reliable information. And we're not going to sugarcoat things, because in the long run, which may be just a week, you know, people are going to find out, oh, there's a lot more cases of coronavirus and they weren't telling the truth. And it's hard to regain trust once you've created that disinformation for people.
How important is data from China on this disease and the results they had in their containment and treatment efforts? How much do you trust that data?
It's hard to know how much to trust it. I think some of this is pride. Some of this is uncertainty and not wanting, you know, necessarily bad information out there. The contrast is, say, with Singapore, which has been fantastically transparent. All the data is available and you have a lot of faith that you know exactly what's happening in that city state. And that's the sort of model we all ought to adopt. But we do use the data. You know, what people regularly say, well, 80% of people, it's a very mild case or they're even asymptomatic. Well, that's based on data from China. We don't know, you know, how reliable that is. And second of all, that might be slightly different in the United States. They have a very high smoking rate, for example, in China, especially among men. And that may be skewing. They may have more serious cases than we're likely to see or we might see in the United States. On the other hand, we have more obese people, and that may skew it so that we have more serious and complicated cases. You know, it's just hard to know how to extrapolate that data.
Former health policy advisor in the Obama White House, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, now Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Take care.
Across the globe, pharmacies are running short on some key supplies needed to combat the coronavirus. That is partly our fault. Many people are in panic mode, fearing the worst, and scooping up more than they need. It's understandable. Still, it's creating shortages. As the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports, there's one critical item that's now hard to find in many places.
Maybe you've been hearing advice like this.
The Department of Homeland Security says stock up on medicines for yourself and your children, like pain relievers, cough and cold medicines,
chicken broth, soups, all that.
Antibacterial soap and wipes, tissues, and laundry and dish detergents.
But there's one item that's often among the first to go. Toilet paper. Call it one of the mysteries of the human psyche. But in times of crisis, human beings stockpile TP. That's been the case in China, Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong, and now stores in Australia are completely wiped out.
192,000 rolls up for sale, and they were sold out in 30 minutes.
Yeah, I'm doing a giant shopping too because everyone else is. And there's no toilet paper. Gotta look for a new way to wipe my bum now.
Woolworths, the Australian supermarket chain, is limiting toilet paper to 4 packs a person. People are hawking toilet paper online for outlandish prices. And listeners are calling into radio stations to win the Cadillac of toilet papers, packs of 3-ply.
Cal, we got a roll just for you.
Awesome.
It's 3-ply as well. We don't ban stuff around.
The hashtags toilet paper emergency and toilet paper apocalypse are trending on Twitter and Facebook. And my favorite Seinfeld episode has been making the rounds on Australian social media, where Elaine goes to the bathroom.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. This is kind of embarrassing, but there's no toilet paper over here.
She's asking the woman in the next stall for a little help.
So if you could spare some. No, I'm sorry. What? No, I'm sorry, I can't spare it.
But thankfully for Australians, the satirical newspaper NT News has come to the rescue. It printed 8 extra pages that readers can use if they're caught short. Sure, it ain't 3-ply, but still a sweet gesture. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A ray of hope for Syria, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russian President Vladimir Putin met in Moscow today to discuss the situation in northwest Syria. At a press conference, Putin said the situation has become so aggravated that it requires a direct personal conversation. After 6 hours of talks, the two leaders announced a ceasefire in Idlib province in Syria's northwest. In recent weeks, the fighting has grown increasingly violent. Turkish military and Syrian government forces, backed by Russia, have repeatedly clashed. Caught in the middle of it all, Syrian civilians. The World's Charles Maines is in Moscow following the talks. I asked him about the negotiations.
Well, they did take a while. 6 hours, in fact, three of which were spent one-on-one between Putin and Erdogan. They were later joined by their delegations. Now, Putin described it as a tense but constructive dialogue. Why don't we listen in just a bit of what he had to say in a statement that they made afterwards?
не всегда согласны с нашими турецкими партнерами в своих оценках происходящего в Сирии. Но каждый раз...
So this is Putin saying basically we don't always agree with our Turkish partners in Syria, but at critical moments we always find a way to, you know, get common ground, and that was the case here. You know, and that seems actually to be true. Both sides, Russia and Turkey, said that they accepted the sovereignty and current territorial integrity of Syria, said they wouldn't let up on the battle against terrorism there, but also emphasized that they only saw a political rather than military solution to the war in Syria. But Erdogan later actually came out with some more details about what they were going to do about Idlib itself. So they announced a ceasefire effective at midnight Thursday. They also announced the creation of humanitarian corridors for the return of refugees. Many of those refugees, of course, have streamed into Turkey or along the Turkish-Syrian border. They also announced joint patrols between Russian and Turkish forces in Idlib, supposedly to try and prevent Syrian regime forces from making attacks against the Turks. But, you know, also important here, that Turkey said they reserve the right to respond to Syrian forces' attacks. The government of Bashar al-Assad, of course, the enemy of the Turkish state.
I mean, ceasefires typically have not held very well during the nearly 10 years of this war in Syria. What sense did you get that this will last from either president?
Well, it seems to be resembling what they've done before. There was something called the Sochi Memorandum from 2019. Essentially, this created a demilitarized zone in Idlib. This was part of a deal that Russia made with Turkey, essentially to keep them happy in this very complex group of alliances that Russia's unveiled in its Syrian campaign. But Assad, you know, he insisted his armies will take Idlib back. He was on Russian state media yesterday in an interview saying that it was just a matter of time. So I think there is reason to be skeptical. And it was, in fact, those attacks against Idlib that drove this recent refugee crisis, which launched the Turkish response. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned.
So you mentioned the Sochi agreement. Does this ceasefire change anything in that agreement?
Well, it does in a sense. Some of the Sochi demarcation lines have shifted a bit. But the essential idea is the same. And again, what's different here, of course, is now you have these joint patrols of Russian and Turkish forces in this area of Idlib designed to prevent Assad from attacking Turkish forces.
How does Putin see Russia's relationship with Turkey going forward? What's his plan?
Well, you know, for Russia, keeping Turkey happy in a way is very important because it plays to this larger game Russia has, with the Kremlin using gas, energy, and even military deals with Turkey to cleave its solidarity within the NATO alliance, of course, Turkey being a NATO member. And Turkey, for its part, uses this kind of flirtation with Russia as a bargaining chip with its Western partners, including the U.S. You know, but I think if you're looking at this relationship in Syria, you know, they haven't solved the larger issues, which is that when it comes to Syria, Russia, its ambitions in the Middle East rest on Assad staying in power. Turkey has its own ambitions as a regional power there, and they want to see Assad go. So today just kind of kicked the can down the road. Maybe it needed kicking, but it's just kicking the can.
What about Russians? How do they feel about this war? Because last year, Charles, you reported on some war booty captured by Russian troops from the Syrian conflict. They had transported these tanks and artillery trucks overland to Russia, a big show of nationalistic pride. Today, are Russians still feeling the same pride?
You know, it's interesting. The Syrian campaign is not particularly popular, yet Russia seems very determined to carry it out. I spoke with a regional specialist here who said, you know, Russia came to Syria not only to help, but to stay. He predicts that they'll be there for the next 50 years. And again, their success there depends on Assad's success. On the other hand, Putin has really had to shift in his recent term in office. He's seen his ratings go down here a bit. And so there's a real effort to address Russians' domestic concerns. And that's hard to do when you're spending on an expensive military campaign in Syria.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Nearly a million civilians have been displaced by the fighting in northwest Syria, and many have fled toward Turkey. We want you to meet one of them, a Syrian mother who left her home with her husband and two young children. Now she's living with family near the Syrian-Turkish border. She asked to remain anonymous because she fears for her safety.
There is heavy shelling during the day and the night. Every single minute there is an airstrike or a shelling attack. Shelling even has been reaching Idlib city, which has up to 1 million civilians. People here are forced from their homes to seek safety here on the Turkish border, carrying only the clothes they wear. most of them don't have money to rent a house or don't know where to go. Camps are full. Now I'm renting an apartment in a building. On my floor, there are 5 apartments, and each apartment of them has 3 to 5 families together. For me, as a mom, life is unfair. It's unfair at all. I hope a better life, of course, for me and for my family, for my 2 young children, who knows nothing of this life except war, except explosions, except displacement. I and my husband do our best to make them safe and to make them live. I think the world knows everything about our crisis and our suffering. We have been living this war for 9 years, and I think we deserve a better life for us and for our children. I hope if the world or the international community could deliver ceasefire, just to live safe. Our only goal now is to live safe.
The voice there of one Syrian woman displaced by fighting. Our story was produced by Daniel Offman and Ian Koss. For several years, the war in Syria has created a migration crisis across the Middle East and the Mediterranean. The situation is flaring up right now at the border between Greece and Turkey. Tomorrow, we'll hear from the world's Lydia Emanuelidou at that border. You're listening to The World. Vietnam's own Lady Gaga. 10 years ago, Mai Khoi was the biggest pop star in Vietnam. But then she broke the rules, thumbing her nose at Vietnam's censorship board and the fashion police.
If you keep wearing this dress, I will ban you from singing in public forever.
I'm Marco Werman. That's still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Afghanistan has been locked in a cycle of war for so long now that it's hard to imagine investigating all of the atrocities and war crimes that may have taken place there. But that is essentially what a court in The Hague says it is going to do. The International Criminal Court today announced that it's going to examine allegations of war crimes committed by 3 groups, the Taliban, Afghan National Security Forces, and the U.S. military, regardless of the fact that the United States is not a signatory to the International Court. The World's Orla Barry reports from London.
This is the first ruling by the International Criminal Court involving the US military. The ICC has focused on the actions of smaller countries in the past, in many cases African nations, and avoided major world players. But today, it ruled that allegations that American forces had committed acts of torture in Afghanistan must be investigated. The court said allegations of war crimes at CIA facilities in Poland, Romania, and Lithuania should also be examined. Human rights advocates welcomed the decision. Preetha Gopalan is with Reprieve, a UK-based human rights group.
It was the right thing to do on all accounts. And because the US has taken on such a hostile campaign against the ICC, I think there was a residual doubt that this would be the decision. But of course, it now is, and we're delighted about that.
The International Court in The Hague also called for a war crimes investigation into the Taliban and the Afghan security forces between 2003 and 2014. The Afghan government didn't respond to today's announcement right away. Daoud Azami from the BBC's Pashto language service said the authorities probably have very mixed feelings.
Well, the Afghan government is keen that the ICC investigates alleged crimes by members of the Taliban. But when it comes to alleged crimes by members of Afghan security forces or other government officials, they say that we are a legitimate government. This is our job, our duty to protect citizens.
The Afghan government is unlikely to cooperate with an ICC investigation, and it's not alone. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today dismissed the ICC's very reason for existence.
This is a truly breathtaking action by an unaccountable political institution masquerading as a legal body.
Pompeo criticized the timing of the decision as well.
It is all the more reckless for this ruling to come just days after the United States signed a historic peace deal on Afghanistan, which is the best chance for peace in a generation. Indeed, the Afghan government itself pleaded with the ICC not to take this course.
But human rights groups say there might be a way forward without U.S. cooperation. Catherine Gallagher is an attorney at the U.S. Center for Constitutional Rights. It represents two men who say they were tortured in secret CIA prisons in Afghanistan. Gallagher says the U.S. may not be a signatory to the ICC, but many other countries are.
Let's see who might end up being indicted and where those people may travel, because 123 member states around the world have an obligation to arrest and turn over to the ICC those who are indicted by the court.
For some, today's decision is deeply personal. Ahmed Rabbani has spent 15 years in Guantanamo prison without charge or trial. He was working as a taxi driver in Pakistan when he was detained in 2002 and sent to Afghanistan. Preetha Gopalan says he never should have been detained in the first place.
He was mistaken for someone quite high ranking in a terrorist organization. He was transported or rendered from Pakistan to several secret detention facilities in Afghanistan. He was tortured severely. And then eventually in 2004, Ahmed was transferred to Guantanamo Bay.
Gopalan says she talked with Rabbani about today's ruling at the ICC. He said all he wants from the US government is an apology.
And he said, you know, even if the government had offered him compensation, £1 million for every day he has spent in detention, that wouldn't be enough. All he wanted were two words: we're sorry.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Roya Rahmani is Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States. We asked her whether her government would block the ICC if it tried to bring an American service member before the court for alleged war crimes in Afghanistan.
We have not decided on our position as of yet, so I cannot comment.
So, Madam Ambassador, the UN report that came out last year that concluded that U.S. and Afghan forces had killed more civilians than the Taliban did during the war. Ultimately, how can families of those victims seek justice?
We are right now at the cusp of an opportunity seeking a peace process. As we go through the process, as people are reconciled, I believe that the question of how to bring to justice and how the families will find justice would be also one of those issues of concern to be discussed.
Well, let's discuss those prospects for peace. Talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban are slated for March 10th. The Afghan government was not part of the first round of talks between the Taliban and the U.S. One possible point of compromise has been this release of prisoners, a prisoner swap, although it's also a point of friction between the U.S. and Afghan governments. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking today.
All the parties understand that it's time for prisoner exchanges to take place. A number of the prisoners being held to serve their full sentences. We need to move that process forward. It will be political. Both sides think they have leverage. But what we have urged all the parties to do is stop posturing. It's time to move forward.
Is Secretary Pompeo sending a message there to Afghanistan's government to just move more quickly to release Taliban prisoners?
It's a process that they have been working together. There is work still under process. And of course, we have taken lots of measures in terms of preparing for the talks, and there is more work on the way.
Just listening to Pompeo there, did that sound to you like the voice of someone who is fully behind the Afghan government?
We have been reassured time and again by our U.S. partners, by the people in the administration, that the United States is continuing to back the Afghan forces, the people of Afghanistan, the gains that we have had. And that's also something that Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, ended his remarks today in the same conversation that you have been playing.
And President Trump, in announcing the agreement this weekend, seemed to suggest that going forward, the Taliban would be eliminating terrorists in Afghanistan. Here's what he said.
I'll be meeting personally with Taliban leaders in the not-too-distant future. And we'll be very much hoping that they will be doing what they say they're going to be doing. They will be killing terrorists. They will be killing some very bad people. They will keep that fight going.
Ambassador Trump also said that if the fight doesn't work out, the U.S. can always go back. What do you make of that?
The agreement that is between the Taliban and the United States is a conditional one. This is something that the U.S. administration has always spoken about. President Trump, in every statement he has always made, he has used the word if we succeed, if we get to an agreement. So he is continuously pointing and emphasizing to the conditionality of the obligations that is laid out in the agreement. And what he is saying, again, is in the same line. They have to abide by what we agree. And this is my understanding that the President Trump is referring to.
Finally, Ambassador, the Taliban, as we all know, they've not placed women in positions of authority. Can you imagine the Taliban negotiating across the table from you or other women?
It is imperative that they agree to that, because this is the new Afghanistan. If they were to ignore 50% of the population, peace would be absolutely an impossibility to reach.
And is having women at the negotiating table something that you personally are going to insist on?
Absolutely. I have been assured by our government that they will ensure representation on the negotiation table. But not only that, they will make sure that women are not presented in the negotiation table as an issue, as a topic, but as representatives of the Afghan government, of the people of Afghanistan, of our nation. So they will have full agency, and the outcome would not compromise the rights of women in Afghanistan.
Roya Rahmani is Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The U.S. Justice Department tried to keep it quiet, but their announcements still set off alarm bells. A new office has been established that will comb through files to try and find people who may have misrepresented themselves while going through the citizenship process. Critics worry that it's an attempt by the Trump administration to strip new Americans of their citizenship. Here's the world's Rupa Shenoy.
John Bash, the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Texas, says the new unit will find cases where immigrants lied in the process of becoming U.S. citizens and get a judge to strip them of that status.
And we've been doing that. We've stepped that up 200% in the last 3 years. But it's getting to the point where we're getting enough referrals that it's time to stand up a standalone unit. And so we have 20 to 30 lawyers dedicated to bringing justice to victims of child molestation, to victims of terrorism, war crimes, and so forth.
This was Bash in an interview on Laura Ingraham's Fox News show. She read him a statement from the ACLU that says the new unit reveals President Trump's systematic campaign against people of color.
Is that really what's going on here, John? You're just willy-nilly going after people of color and just stripping them of their citizenship for no reason?
No, I mean, that is an outrageous statement that really impugns the integrity of all the career attorneys at DOJ that work on these issues.
But examining the records of naturalized citizens to look for fraud wasn't a government priority until the Trump administration. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants become U.S. citizens every year. In all, there are 20 million naturalized Americans, and very few have been stripped of citizenship. During the Obama administration, officials investigated, on average, about 50 immigrants a year for possible denaturalization. Cassandra Robertson says those cases came up as thousands of old immigration records were digitized and reviewed for the first time. Robertson directs the Center for Professional Ethics at Case Western Reserve Law School in Ohio.
Digitization made it easier to go back and look at the older records and see if there were errors or problems in earlier immigration files. Under the Obama administration, the purpose of that was to look for national security threats.
But the project's first successful case, announced in 2018, was against an Indian immigrant without a criminal record. A judge revoked Baljinder Singh's citizenship because Singh used a different name when he first entered the country 3 decades ago. Still, last year, the Trump administration sought to expand the project. It asked for $200 million to investigate roughly 900 American citizens and digitize and review another 700,000 old immigration files.
The people that they've been going after really don't seem to have any connection to prior war crimes or terrorism or threats to national security.
In New York, attorney Matthew Colkin says he's seen an influx of about two dozen panicked, naturalized citizens who've been notified of proceedings against them by the government. An old immigration document, newly digitized, shows they changed some detail they told officials long ago and never disclosed doing so. So they're charged with fraud. And fraud is grounds for being stripped of citizenship.
Realistically, almost every single immigrant who's ever applied for status in the United States has at one point or another failed to disclose something that's material.
Colkin's been able to keep all his clients in the country legally, but he warns immigrants who want to apply for citizenship that now is not the best time. Despite that, and the announcement of a new Department of Justice unit focused on denaturalizations, Los Angeles resident Estefania Lopez Perez is still urging her mother to go through the process to become a citizen.
Having that naturalization, you're fully American, quote unquote, and having her have that would be kind of a sigh of relief for everybody.
Because it still just feels safer to be a citizen, especially now when many non-citizens feel at risk of deportation, says Lopez Perez. She was brought to the U.S. from El Salvador when she was 5, and she became a naturalized citizen 2 years ago.
I wanted to gain the right to vote.
In this coming election, 1 in 10 eligible voters are naturalized citizens, and Lopez Perez hopes those voters will be thinking about all the unanswered questions raised by the Trump administration's new office focused on denaturalizations.
I don't know if they're going to be only looking into cases of people that have committed crimes and then looking into cases of people that may have inadvertently lied or said something wrong, or maybe be involved in a political organization, or maybe have said something against the Trump administration on social media. I mean, like, I don't know when it will stop.
The more questions she and her family have, Lopez Perez says, the more fearful they'll be about the future. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
One of Vietnam's best-known singers is a woman known as Mai Khoi. I met her recently in New York, where she's been living for the past few months, an artist residency doubling as a little time out from the stress of being an artist in Vietnam. Mai Khoi's evolution is a little unexpected. 10 years ago, she was gaining a reputation as a pop star.
Hey, I'm a girl from Vietnam. I write a song about Vietnam. I want to sing about Vietnam.
She stayed with that smooth sound for a while, but Mai Khoi would later be talked about as Vietnam's Lady Gaga. Even when you were a pop star, kind of like a mainstream pop star in Vietnam, when you won the Song of the Year competition, you came out with a VN shaved in your head to
yes.
symbolize Vietnam. So already there was a glimmer that you were not a normal pop star. You had something to say, I think. Was that kind of the moment where you said, I'm not going to submit my music anymore. I'm changing my life.
At that moment, I was so happy because the award is very big for a Vietnamese musician. So I was so happy, and I just shaved VN on my head, the name of my song, to celebrate my award. And I showed them a new look of the Vietnamese woman can be. But not many people like it. they didn't like it. But it's still like many newspaper and magazine write about my haircut, and they say, Mai Khoi new haircut against the Vietnamese traditional image.
So you've really got a reputation for yourself in Vietnam.
Actually, I can't represent it for Vietnam or for Vietnamese woman. But through my story, people can understand a little bit a part of what's going on in Vietnam.
Mới cần vào trong đó ngồi.
So explain how your musical side discovered your activist side, or did your activist side discover your musical side?
When I was a pop star, I know how to deal with the censorship system. So I get famous, but I couldn't feel free to create. So I start to find the way to fight the censorship system. And when I transferred to a human rights activist, I feel my music different from before. My music more emotion, more feelings, and it make my soul richer and my music richer.
Explain for us how the censorship system in Vietnam works. You write a song, and then what has to happen?
We have to ask the permission from the government before we do anything. Organize an exhibition, organize a concert, do a charity show, or even organize a private show in your private house. You need to ask the permission. You have to submit the content of your program to the culture department. You have to pay money, you have to follow the censor's idea. One time I was performing in the rehearsal room for five people from the culture department. And suddenly one people stand up and shout on me, "Who allowed you to wear this dress?"
Who allowed you to wear the dress that you're wearing while you're performing
them? Like, if you keep wearing the dress, I will ban you from singing in public forever. I can do that. They can ban me if I say something back.
So what happens now? I mean, you've basically refused to submit your songs to the Vietnamese censors, correct?
Since 2016 until now, I just released my song on internet. And I don't ask for the permission. I organized my private concert in a private studio without asking permission. And the police came to raid my shows 2 times.
So if you continue to sing and write songs without passing them through the censors in Vietnam, what risks do you face?
They isolate me from the community. The national media stop talking about me. No one dared to book me to sing, so they cut the way I earned a living. And it's very difficult for me to get my audience now because even the internet, they control the internet right now.
How do you work then as an artist in those circumstances? Would you have to leave Vietnam? I mean, you're here in New York right now, but you're not here for very long, right? A few months.
I feel very difficult to release my new songs, but I'm still doing that. I'm still lucky because I can still travel around the world to sing my songs, to tell my story. But in Vietnam, I cannot do that.
So you're kind of backed into a corner about where you can perform and what you can do. How does that make you feel as an artist with something to say?
When artists can't perform, it hurts so much, but it makes you want to create more.
Tonight, if you're in New York City, you can hear for yourself how that political pressure has amplified Mai Khoi's creativity. She's performing at Joe's Pub in a show she calls Just Be Patient. That phrase is Mai Khoi's takeaway from meeting President Obama in Hanoi in 2016.
We have a very popular artist here who is speaking out on behalf of freedom of speech and expression and artists throughout Vietnam.
Mai Khoi was seated just to Obama's left when he made those comments, and she wondered what the future would hold for her and her country when she heard this.
Ultimately, it's up to the Vietnamese people to determine how their society functions and the nature of their government.
Mai Khoi and other Vietnamese artists are still wondering when things will change. Right now, she's not sure she can return to Vietnam and openly be the musician she wants to be.
Cho chúng tôi được đưa tiền cho ông.
để ông cho chúng tôi được làm việc.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Cho chúng tôi được dõi lừa theo ông, để ông cho chúng tôi.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.